Hi, Ross Sutherland here, jumping in at the top to remind you that Imaginary Advice is funded exclusively through listener donations. There are no adverts, no sponsors, just you. If you'd like to help fund the show, you can make a monthly donation via www.patreon.com/RossGSutherland. Supporters get access to a bonus podcast series, plus there are other perks too. Alternatively, you can make a one-off donation at buymeacoffee.com/imaginary advice. And both those links are in the show notes of the episode. Also, if you'd like an email notification for new episodes of the show, you can now get that by going to my website, imaginaryadvice.com, and clicking on the heading for my mailing list. I send one email a month on release day, nothing else. I used to use social media for these kinds of notifications, but, you know, it's only taken me a decade to realise that that's a terrible way to keep in touch with listeners. So, if you'd like to stay in the loop for this show, go to imaginaryadvice.com.
Last time on Third Phase.
In 1995, their dad secretly bought a one-way flight to Portugal, saddling Mike and Jane with about 70 grand's worth of debt. The other day, we was remembering the time you burnt down the McDonald's. Do you remember? It was an accident. Yeah, a lot of accidents happen when you were around, don't they, Mikey? New Year's Eve, the turn of a new millennium. There was a black pillbox on the table. Remember, the first phase is white, then purple, then green. I'm not actually magically travelling through pictures. I ran into that billboard and knocked myself out. And now all of this is just in my head. He was stood on his own face. Want a lift? My appearance automatically means that something has gone seriously wrong with your pharmaceutical journey. A stressful dream may trigger a full-blown psychotic break, leaving you in a permanent vegetative state. The second way you can end up brain dead is if you remain in this dream when your dose of sulfurazine enters its third and final phase. By the time that third bomb hits, you need to be awake, Michael. Otherwise, your frontal lobes will end up fried like a couple of Spam fritters. And then he exploded in a puff of confetti. Right between his eyebrows, right about on the spot where his third eye would be, a McDonald's. He must have been here 40, 50 times as a kid, before he burnt it to the ground, of course. There was only one person in the restaurant. His dad pushed over a box of chicken nuggets. "There you go, Mikey," he said. "Eat."
And now, the story continues.
Mike looked at the box of chicken nuggets. They didn't look particularly appetizing. Then again, they never did. "Michael," said his dad, "I bought you this to say sorry. However, if you don't accept my apology, I can eat them myself if you want." This was very much the standard script from Dad. They were role-playing a, call it a family tradition. How many times had his dad brought Mike to this restaurant to essentially bribe his silence? Mike popped one in his mouth. It had a strange metallic taste, like sucking on a coin. "Now, I don't need to tell you that your mum's got enough on her plate, yeah? She sees that mark on your neck, she's only going to get upset. and she can't get upset, not in her condition. So we keep this between us, yeah? Mike didn't say anything. It was strange to be back here again, listening to these old lines. It was like playing back an old folk song. There are folk songs about battering your kids, right? Songs about chucking your 9-year-old son across a table, right? Yeah, well, one of those songs. A group of extremely agitated chimney sweeps had gathered outside the window. They were leaving sooty fingerprints all over the glass. The horde seemed to have surrounded the entire restaurant. There was maybe 100 of them now. It was hard to tell exactly. One particularly distracting chimney sweep, who was little more than a burning skull in a stovepipe hat, was pushed right up against the glass, giving Mike the wanker sign. "Look," said his dad, "I only did it because you provoked me. Things got a little heated, but I only did it to teach you a lesson, okay? You have to learn respect." Before, the sky had been sheer black. A complete absence of everything. But now it was a dark, dark shade of green. Green for three. Three for green. The final phase was on its way. He could feel it closing in. If Mike understood correctly, the green phase heralded the third and final explosion in his brain, and unless he woke up before it hit, the explosion was going to lock him away inside this dream forever. He probably had 5 minutes till total brain death. After that, he would be trapped in this burning house of a brain until there was nothing left to burn. So that was fun. Also, if that wasn't enough pressure, said brain death could also be triggered if he steered his dream into a stressful situation. Say, for example, just to pick a random scenario out of thin air, like hanging out with your abusive estranged dad in the exact building you burnt down when you were 15 years old. Something like that. Mike took a long, slow breath. If the final phase was coming, so be it. There was nothing he could do about that. However, he wasn't going to give in to this fucker. Absolutely no way was he giving the old bastard the satisfaction of taking him down. So, whatever the prick said, whatever he did, Mike was going to let it pass right through him. His face would remain a frozen lake. "Oi," said his dad, "stop looking out the window. What's so interesting about what's happening out there, eh?" Mike pointed to the 20 demonic chimney sweeps scrabbling at the window. "Are you serious?" said Mike. "Look at these guys. You don't find this in the least bit distracting?" "Yeah, yeah," said his dad. "I've seen it all before." "This," said Mike. "You've seen this. These pricks have been chasing me ever since I fell asleep. They ate Jane twice. I have no idea what their deal is, but I tell you, I am absolutely sick of it." His dad didn't even look up from his chips. "You know who they are," he said. "You know what they represent." "No," said Mike. "I don't." "Yeah, you do. They're everything you've ever done wrong. Everyone you've ever hurt. All your dirty secrets. That's who they are." Mike looked again. It was hard to properly see them under all that soot and grime. Maybe he recognized some faces. He couldn't be sure.
Well, said Mike, if they want me, why don't they just come in and get me? I didn't lock the door. It's McDonald's. They can just come on in.
Why would they come in here? Said Dad.
They've been trying to chase you here all night. This is where they want you. Here. With me. Where you belong.
His dad chucked a chip in his mouth, then went back to his racing pages. Mike felt the hairs on the back of his neck stand on end. He knew that he shouldn't, but he couldn't help himself.
So, said Mike, I was wondering, what exactly was it that I did to you that made you hate me so much?
You know what you did,
said his dad.
No, said Mike. I mean, I've always known that you hated me, but I'm not sure I ever knew why. And don't say because of the fire, because we both know you hated me long before that.
Well,
said his dad, folding his newspaper.
I mean, just pick a day, Mikey, because there was always something, always causing trouble. You couldn't help yourself. You know what you were like. Christ, I mean, you're the same now.
Okay, said Mike. So there was always something, yeah?
Always,
said his dad.
Tell me the worst. Just give me the headline, or top three, if you like. I won't force you to rank them. I just want to hear you say them out loud. Tell me what it was that I did that meant I had to be punished the way you punished me.
You know what you did.
We're not discussing my memory here. My memory of getting knocked about is not the fucking issue here. What I am asking is for you to say out loud one thing I did that you think deserved what you did to me.
Why?
I don't know, but something tells me the second you say your reason out loud, I'm going to hear just how fake it is. Because that's why you won't say it, isn't it? Because there's no way you can justify what you did to me. What was it I did that made you hate me so much? It must have been something I did when I was really young, because no matter how far back I think that, I don't remember any other version of you. Look, I know you're not the real guy. You're just a version of my dad that I carry around in my head. Obviously, I'm not expecting you to know anything that I don't know, but still, Jesus Christ, I am a little shocked by just how two-dimensional you're coming across here, Dad. You're basically just a curtain with a face printed on it. I mean, if you really are the version of him that I keep in my brain, then it kind of suggests that I didn't really know him at all. Don't you think?
Jesus, maybe Jane was right about me. Maybe I've had all the pieces of the puzzle in the wrong order all these years. I built my whole life story around you, you absolute shit. But there's nothing really there, is there? You're not there. I don't know you. You're fucking missed.
And you're a moron, said his dad. You're pathetic. You're weak. And you get what you deserve, which is nothing. Including these nuggets. I'm eating these nuggets. You just lost nugget privileges.
You still can't do it, can you? You still can't name one thing that I did that justifies what you did to...
Okay, fine, fine, fine,
said his dad, smacking the box of nuggets onto the floor.
You really want to know what you did to me? I'll fucking show you. I'll show you what an evil little shit you are, Michael Banks. I'll show you why you deserved every fucking smack to the head. If that's what you want, fine, but you won't like it.
Then he got up and walked out the back door. Behind the McDonald's, there was a candle-lit path leading up the side of the mountain. The mountain that was actually a 3,000 times facsimile of Mike's own nose. Mike came out to find his dad waiting for him at the base of the path.
God help me, I wanted to avoid this,
he barked.
But if you insist, then you have to see it for yourself.
Mike realised the path wasn't actually lit with candles. The chimney sweeps had formed an orderly line on either side of the path, stood to attention like soldiers, but with their heads on fire.
Deep down, you already know what I'm going to show you,
said Dad.
Maybe you've blocked it out, I don't know, but you want to know why I treated you the way I did? Come on.
Mike followed his dad up the path.
It's all right for you,
yelled his dad, marching ahead.
You've got your sister to look after you, and she's got you to look after her. Who is there to look after me? Tell me that. When something terrible happens, what do? Fend for myself, that's what. Who do I tell about it? No one. Don't blab my troubles at home. I just push on, uncomplaining and alone and silent. You want to know what you did to me? You'll see.
The sky was brightening as they climbed. One minute it was dark olive, the colour of the inside of a vine. The next it was sparkling like chlorophyll. The sky, an overturned terrarium, cut through with emerald lightning that put Mike's teeth on edge. How long did he have left? A minute, maybe two. Just enough time to find out who he really was. One last chance to understand himself. And sure enough, soon, there was no more path to climb. Mike peered over the edge of Nose Mountain, looking down at his own face, grey and pockmarked and desolate. The dead lakes of his eyes, the haunted forest of his scratchy beard, and right there in the centre of the forest, the vast chasm of his mouth hanging open, jaw slack. Echo, said Mike.
Echo,
bellowed back the canyon below.
Okay, here it is,
said his dad. He was standing next to a giant wooden trebuchet with the word truth painted hastily on the side of it.
Get in.
What?
Get in,
said his dad again.
Get in and the truth shall be revealed. Then you'll finally understand why I had to do the things I had to do.
Mike looked at the trebuchet. No.
Don't you want to know the truth? Don't you want to know why you deserve to be miserable? I can show you. Just get in the trebuchet and you'll understand. I'm not going to fire it.
You are obviously going to fire it, said Mike. It's very clearly a trap. Is this it?
You brought me up here for absolutely no reason. There's no big reveal, is there? There's no answers, no secret suppressed memories. You just brought me up here to fire me out of a fucking catapult.
No, I didn't, said Dad. Mikey, I promise you, hand on my heart, this is not a trap. However, even if it was a trap, which it isn't, but even if it was a trap, you would have to admit that it would be a trap that you absolutely deserved.
Mike turned, but the chimney sweeps were already upon him, slamming him into the dust, tying his hands, their sulfur breath stinging his sinuses as they hefted his body into the bowl of the catapult, his dad standing over him, extending that little pocket knife of his. Don't, said Mike.
For your own good.
And then Mike was flying through the air, shrieking. The mouth below him shrieking also.
10.
The two sounds folding around each other as he fell from the sky.
9.
Plunging head first towards his own gaping mouth, falling into himself,
8.
Falling into oblivion.
7.
Mike could feel himself slipping away. This moment of self-swallowing would tie a knot around his consciousness that could not be untied. This was brain death.
6.
The darkness engorging him, the vast chasm of his mouth spreading wider and wider, his tiny, flailing body vanishing inside it.
5.
His head turning to catch one last glimpse of sky.
4.
Only to see it erupt.
3.
Into luminescent traffic light green.
2.
Green for 3.
1.
Green for go. The final phase was. And then the mouth was gone. In fact, the entire asteroid head thing was gone, erased, blipped out of existence, along with whatever fate had been waiting for Mike at the bottom of that chasm. He was no longer dying, nor was he falling. Mike hung in empty space, suspended in an endless, featureless ocean of green. A green both hard and soft, like Chinese jade. An immortal, gracious green, protecting him on all sides. The final detonation in his brain had seemingly blown him clear of everything. He was saved. Somehow, the third phase had saved him. The best explanation Mike could come up with was that the psychotic break triggered by his father had somehow exactly coincided with the final explosion in his brain, and that the two threats had somehow cancelled each other out. And now he was here, wherever here was. The green zone. Not falling or floating, but also definitely not standing on anything. There was no more separation between earth and sky. Not only that, but all boundaries were dissolving. He could feel it. Something releasing within him.
Pigeons.
Emptying him of any sense of belonging.
London.
Every structure designed to hold him together.
Dysfunctional family.
Anything that separated his outside from his inside. All boundaries dissolving. The container of his soul splitting open and releasing all the life contained within. Their private universe unleashed, separating into 1,000 pieces, and every single one of those pieces,
siblings living together,
was just as stupid as the next piece.
Horse racing.
There was no way to tell which pieces were important and which ones were incidental. There was no relationship.
Crying.
Between the elements.
Losing one's job.
He could no longer separate his enemies.
Reflection in a mirror.
From his friends.
Medication.
He could no longer distinguish the parts of him that were metaphor from the parts that were flesh and blood.
Object thrown into fireplace.
All that remained was a list of symbols. Perfect. Polished. Sovereign. Things referring only to themselves. Closed loops of meaning held together like particles of water in a cloud.
Windstorm.
Centerless. Blameless. Each symbol had only one purpose.
Umbrella.
Their purpose was to exist, and nothing more. Directions that led nowhere. Jokes without punchlines.
Compulsive, hysterical laughter.
It may have taken seconds, it may have been years, but eventually, from this sea of emptiness, something new began to emerge.
Talking pig.
A new feeling. Something they'd never felt before, which made it hard to give it a name. But maybe you could call it calm. A quietness of the soul.
Levitation.
Like when a glass box is covered with a velvet curtain, and then
magic.
The curtain falls to the floor as if the box had never existed. A feeling that some knot in reality, some horrible mistake, had finally been undone.
Sabotaging a fox hunt.
Once their heart had been a prison.
Run on a bank.
But now, the prisoners had been released.
Suffragette movement.
But for how long? They wondered. This new ecstatic freedom, this uncoupling from the past, was it transitory or permanent? When the drug wore off again, when they woke from this endless green dream, would the feeling retreat? Would they find themselves dumped back into their old life once more, the past rearing up and swallowing them whole?
The year 1910.
Or, if not swallowed by the past, what if they woke to find themselves swallowed by the future? Here, within the safety of the dream, this feeling of emptiness felt profound, it felt powerful, but when they finally woke, released from the green zone of their psyche, would that same feeling of emptiness overwhelm them? Would they wake to find themselves lobotomized,
punching through a hat,
stranded, terrified and alone in a world they no longer recognized?
Nonsense language.
Is that the world they would wake to? How could they go on?
Smog.
How could they create a future for themselves if they no longer had a past? No, they thought. Their past had not been erased. It was still there inside them. They could feel it. It was just
waiting for them to redefine it.
Character separates from their reflection.
It's down to me, they thought. I have to decide which elements are important and which ones are incidental. I get to decide who I see when I look in the mirror tomorrow, and no one else. Only I get to choose the shape of my heart.
St. Paul's Cathedral.
And with this thought, the fragments of their life began to gather once more. From the rubble, something new was starting to bloom.
Fireworks used as weapons.
A new constellation, glittering in the dark.
Pearly King.
No parts destroyed, no parts erased, simply reordered. It was easy, instinctive. A rebirth as painless as walking through a door.
Entering a painting.
Whatever darkness they had been carrying before, it was still there, still part of them. Only now, it had been moved to a new location in their soul. Now it was stored somewhere else, somewhere safer, somewhere less likely to cause an explosion. Just like the old song goes, houses burn when chimneys block. You need a
chimney sweep.
He'll come and unbung all your holes. Just don't forget the sheet. I mean, it's not actually an old song. I made it up. But, you know, it helps thematically tie a couple of things together. So, yeah, I'm just going to pretend it's a real song.
Breaking the fourth wall.
Did I manage to work that one in? It's one of the last items on the list. I can't remember. Sorry, I've been working on this story so long, I'm starting to lose track a bit. Look, is it clear what... Sorry, this is the author, Ross Sutherland here, butting into the narrative just for a second. I am aware that this is a significant moment in the story, and I don't want us to lose our place, not when we're so close to the end. But, that said, can we just touch base, just for a second? I just want to make sure it's clear what's happening with our protagonist here. Just to recap, and I promise, I'll be fast. Michael Banks is unconscious. He's dreaming. We're inside his dream. What we're seeing in Michael's dream is being affected by a drug that Michael has taken, a drug called Suffrazine. Suffrazine is a powerful neurological inhibitor originally designed for the treatment of PTSD. Now, for the majority of Michael's drug experience, the drug has been malfunctioning, partly due to the fact that Michael has taken an unsafe quantity of the drug, but also, possibly, because of a head injury, an allergic reaction, a general unsuitability to the treatment. These factors combined together have positioned Michael at a point of brain death. It seemed as if this fate was somewhat inescapable. However, at the very last second, Michael was saved. It appeared the multiple harbingers of doom burning through Michael's brain had somehow clashed and cancelled each other out, a bit like stepping off the pavement in front of two buses simultaneously, but then both buses smashing into each other and miraculously throwing you clear of the whole shebang. In addition to this miracle escape, it also appears as if Michael's drug experience is finally stabilizing. Now in the grip of Suffrazine's final phase, Michael seems to be having a cathartic, almost transcendent experience, which is nice. Good for him, I guess. However, it does seem extremely intense. Presumably, this is a far more invasive, far more transformative experience than the drug is traditionally supposed to deliver. Suffrazine is supposed to help suppress PTSD. It's not supposed to completely dismantle your psyche. Nevertheless, that's what's happened to Michael here. And as scary as that might sound, apparently, it feels good. Then again, isn't drowning supposed to feel euphoric? Anyway, regardless, the Lego castle of Michael's psyche has crumbled back into a rainbow sea of bricks. His story reduced back to a series of floating concepts. Basically,
everything you heard in this voice.
And now, having been dismantled, Michael has begun the process of reconnecting those concepts in order to create a new version of themselves, which was precisely what was happening at the moment I rudely interrupted the story just now. Now, of course, within the context of this audio drama, this scene is a significant story beat. It's a big moment in Michael's journey. He's crossing a threshold, reimagining himself. It's a turning point. But in addition to its narrative importance, this scene also has a secret secondary purpose, a meta purpose, you could say, because it's also my opportunity to show you guys that, yes, fuck you. You thought I couldn't do it, but I did. I included every single IMDb plot keyword from the film Mary Poppins in this story. And so, suck it. I did it. That promise I made way back in the introduction to this story, way back all those months ago, in the opening minutes of episode 101, I absolutely smashed it. Smashed it with my big brain. Fuck you if you didn't think I could do it. I am God. You are shit. Fuck you. So yeah, I mean, I didn't expect it to take me 4 fucking episodes, but still, I did it, okay? And that's, yeah, no, that's all I wanted to say. So anyway, now, back to the story. Actually, just, if I can just, one more. The thing is, when I first started writing this piece, I didn't have an outline for it. I just picked a couple of random items from the keyword list as an arbitrary starting point, and I just worked outwards from there. I swear, I had no idea where it was going, not to begin with. I mean, I think I've been working on a text for a couple of months before I even realised that the subject of abuse was going to play a significant part in the story. Well, I mean, abuse and the traumatic response to abuse. I had no idea that this was where the story was going to take me. And that kind of took me by surprise. All the same, over time, I found myself being drawn towards this particular idea. The idea that past trauma tends to live on inside a person as a kind of story. And it is extremely hard for a person to break free of that trauma when they've been telling themselves this exact same story 1,000 times a day, every single day of their life. Breaking free of a story like that is very, very hard. But I do believe it can be done. Like, in all circumstances, I believe it can be done. Eventually. With time and energy, therapy, reflection, in some cases, medication. But the process is slow. The story has to be unpicked line by line. And I don't know if this needs to be said, but I seriously doubt there will ever be a miracle drug that can completely circumnavigate this process. Some parts, I'm sure, can and have been medicalized, but there can never be a miracle pill that will instantaneously free us from the destructive stories that we use to torture ourselves. That said, from certain angles, this transcendent experience happening to Michael right now might look like a tacit endorsement of miracle drugs, or, you know, general pharmaceutical quackery. Can I really write an ending for my story where Michael emerges from an overdose of a dangerous MHRA rejected brain drug and actually finds himself miraculously relieved of his traumatic past? An ending like that, that isn't just accidentally stepping into the road in front of two buses which somehow hit each other instead of hitting you. That's accidentally stepping into the road in front of two buses which somehow hit each other instead of hitting you, and also a piece of shrapnel from the bus crash goes right through your side and perfectly surgically removes your appendix, which was seconds away from bursting. In fact, that was why you were being careless with your road safety in the first place. You were stumbling across town in a fit of agony, trying to get a hospital before your appendix burst. And FYI, you weren't going to make it. So thank God you were being so careless, stepping out into traffic like an idiot, because jumping in front of a bus has quite literally saved your life. It's like that. A happy ending for Michael is as stupid as a bus shrapnel appendectomy. No, it's worse. It's even more perverse than that. And it's not just the complete jettisoning of realism, because I've never particularly cared about that. It's the moral implication. I'm sorry, it is. It's the moral implication. If I wanted to keep this story in line with my personal opinions on, you know, the limitations of wonder drugs, etc., then really, there's no way the story can have a happy ending. So things can't work out for Michael, right? That's what I'm saying. He might be having this transcendent experience right now, having the puzzle pieces of his life pulled apart and put back together again. And I know at this moment in the story, there's perhaps a feeling of hope around Michael for the first time since we joined him. But surely, I can't give him a happy ending. I can't. But I am. I think I am. Somehow, I'm going to give Michael a happy ending. And I know I shouldn't. I stand by everything I just said, but fuck it. I want things to work out all right for Michael. I need him to walk away from all this and be better. I think he's been tortured enough. Now, initially, I thought maybe I could just leave Michael here, in this moment, returned to a kind of primordial soup, a gaseous state from which he could gather himself into anyone. I thought that might be enough, you know? I'd taken him back beyond the beginning of his story, right back, actually, to a moment in the prologue, back when I was describing a figure sitting in my audience playing the IMDb game, excited as to what the answer might be. And that's what Michael's become now. A nameless character, a kind of proto-person, just a pair of ears listening to this list of concepts, waiting patiently for a familiar pattern to emerge. After all, from this moment, anything can happen, right? All permutations are permitted. The future is unwritten. I thought maybe simply by taking him back to this point, that would be enough. But I don't know. If we leave Michael while he's still in the dream, if we end this story while he's still in pieces, yet to reform himself, this ending, it might be interpreted as signifying that Michael never wakes up. that the dream consumes him, after all. And I didn't like that interpretation. Plus, it's messy. It makes the whole story lopsided. Oh, what? Like, we leave the real world in episode 2 and never come back to it at the end? Like, what about the farmer? What about Mike taking the blame for the warehouse accident? What about Jane? No, you can't just plow into the dream and then dump him there. That doesn't feel right. We have to have Michael wake up at the end. We can't leave him in his dream, in this uncreated gaseous state, even if he's happy here. No, it's a cop-out, so no, we're not doing that. In one draft of the ending, I had Michael waking up from his drug overdose to discover that he was now the other Michael Banks, i.e. the one from the film Mary Poppins. In this ending, the restructuring of Michael's brain has somehow allowed him to mentally transport himself into a completely different reality. And so he wakes to find that he has been transformed into a precocious 10-year-old living in late Edwardian London, with a new nanny arriving at the door, Sherman Brothers music hall ringing in his ears. Michael, in this ending, has somehow reorganized the details of his childhood trauma and turned those fragments into something beautiful and heartwarming in a Walt Disney kind of way. Somehow, Michael has cracked the IMDb game himself, that list of plot keywords miraculously snapping back to its original shape. And suddenly, Michael's no longer a wasted fuckhead with scars up his back from cigarette burns. No. Just like that, he's in Mary Poppins. Every piece of Mikey's jigsaw instantly reset to the original illustration on the box. He wakes in his bed at 17 Cherry Tree Lane. Bleary-eyed, Michael goes through to the nursery, and right there in front of him, it's Jane, his sister. And for a second, Mike remembers the other Jane, the one from his life before, but the memory quickly tears and fades. And soon, all that remains is this feeling. Michael knows that he needs to hug her, and he does, even though he doesn't know why. And now he's hearing his father's voice from downstairs and his mother's voice too. Michael's never heard those voices before, but somehow they're also the voices he knows better than any other. Their parents are asking them to come downstairs and meet their new nanny. And so Jane and Michael walk hand in hand down the stairs. And it's only a happy ending if you choose to not really think about it. If you're only engaging with the story on a vague conceptual level, then yeah, it's a happy ending. Comparing this new matrix of keywords to the matrix of keywords Michael was trapped in before, then, well, yeah, this version is far more pleasant. But to me, this still reads like a version of the story where Michael never truly wakes up. It still feels too much like a continuation of his dream. A happy dream, but a dream nevertheless. So, I don't know. To me, it still reads as brain death. You'd hear that ending and immediately start revising the last act of the story. So, rather than that third detonation saving Michael and releasing him from the nightmare about his father, it now seems as if that final micro explosion essentially caused an avalanche that trapped him inside his mind forever. The third final phase of Safrazine, seemingly sealing his fate. Also, let's be honest, escaping into Mary Poppins is not a healthy way to move on from your past. It's a rejection of everything. And what does that say about life after trauma? It's possible, but only if you seal yourself away in a fantasy world. It doesn't work. It doesn't track. Not for me. And so I scrapped that ending. I scrapped it. Trapping someone inside a Mary Poppins-themed coma isn't really helping them, you know? Even if it's conceptually satisfying for the arc of the radio drama to end the story the same way it began, it doesn't help Michael. Not really. And I want to help Michael. Yeah, it's all I want to do. So, yeah, I scrapped it. I said to myself, whatever happens, Michael has to wake up. Whatever the end of the story is, Mikey has to return to the world I first created for him. If this is to be a true happy ending, he has to wake up. He has to. And, yeah. So he did. So much for listening. I'm aware that a multi-part story like this is a much bigger commitment than the podcast usually requires, so thank you for giving it a shot. I hope you'll come back for the final part of this mini-series in exactly 1 month's time, if you're listening at time of release. One more quick notice. If you're a subscriber to my Patreon or interested in joining, this month, I'm going to be starting a brand new series on my Patreon-only podcast. The series is called Untitled Horror Screenplay : The Podcast. That's Untitled Horror Screenplay : The Podcast. Trips off the tongue. And, I've just started work on the screenplay for a horror film. And this podcast is an audio diary of my progress. As a patron of the pod, you actually get to help shape the story. There'll be voting on plot details, stuff like that. It's a collaborative effort, basically. That's how I'm envisaging it. Something we can grapple with together. Also, if it's bad, then we only have ourselves to blame, don't we? I've only just started on this new journey. So it's a good time to hop on board if you're interested. It's not just for fans of horror. I'm hoping that anyone with an interest in storytelling will hopefully get a kick out of it. Find more details about my Patreon in the show notes of this episode. Alternatively, if you want to make a one-off donation to the show, you can do that by going to buymeacoffee.com/imaginaryadvice. Next month on the feed, final phase reaches its finale. Till then, again, thanks so much for listening. My name is Ross Sutherland. All this time, you have been listening to Imaginary Advice. Bye.